watches the ice cube sag into liquid. Dying pours water over the cubes. She is burning up herself. The club's open windows do nothing to catch the breeze, and at this early hour, the swelter inside the building is still overwhelming. None of the yellow card fan men have arrived yet, either. The club radiates heat from walls and floor, encasing them. Raleigh takes a swallow of his cool water. Emiko watches, burning, wishing she could sweat.
Kun, Raleigh, please, so sorry, please,
she hesitates.
A cold drink.
Raleigh sips his water and watches as more of his girls filter in.
Keeping a wind-up is damn expensive.
Emiko smiles embarrassment, hoping to assuage him. Finally, Raleigh makes a face of irritation.
Fine.
He nods to Dayang. A glass of ice water is passed across. Emiko tries not to lunge for it. She holds it to her face and neck, almost gasping with relief. She drinks and presses the glass against herself again, clutching it like a talisman.
Thank you.
Why should I help you get out of the city?
I will die if I stay here.
It's not good business. Wasn't good business to hire you, and it's definitely not good business to bribe you all the way north.
Please, anything. I will pay it. I will do it. You may use me.
He laughs. I've got real girls.
His smile disappears.
The problem, Emiko, is that you've got nothing to give. You drink the money you earn every night. Your bribes cost money. Your ice costs money. If I weren't so nice, I'd just throw you out in the street for the white shirts to mulch.
You're not a good business proposition.
Please.
Don't piss me off. Go get ready for work. I want you out of your street clothes when the customers arrive.
His words have the finality of true authority. Reflexively, Emiko starts to bow, acquiescing to his wishes. She stops short.
You are not a dog,
she reminds herself.
You are not a servant. Service has gotten you abandoned amongst demons in a city of divine beings. If you act like a servant, you will die like a dog.
She straightens.
So sorry. I must go north, Raleigh-san. Soon. How much would it cost? I will earn it.
You're like a goddamn Cheshire.
Raleigh stands suddenly.
You just keep coming back to pick over the debt.
Emiko flinches. Even though he is old, Raleigh is still Gaijin, born and fed before the contraction. He stands tall. She takes another step back, unnerved by his sudden loom. Raleigh smiles grimly.
That's right. Don't forget your place. You'll go north, all right. But you'll do it when I'm good and ready. And not until you've earned every butt for the white shirt bribes.
How much?
His face reddens.
More than you've made till now.
She jumps back, but Raleigh grabs her. He yanks her close. His voice is a low whiskey growl.
You were useful to someone once. So I see how a wind-up like you might forget herself. But let's not fool ourselves. I own you.
His bony hand fumbles at her breast, seizes a nipple and twists. She whimpers in pain and wilts under his hand. His pale blue water eyes watch her like a snake's.
I own every part of you,
he murmurs.
If I want you mulched tomorrow, you're gone. No one will care. People in Japan might value a wind-up. Here, you're just trash.
He squeezes again. She takes a shuddering breath, trying to keep her feet. He smiles.
I own you. Remember that.
He releases her abruptly. Emiko stumbles back and catches the bar's edge. Raleigh returns to his drink.
I'll let you know when you've earned enough to go north, he says. But you'll work for it, and work for it good. No more of your picky ways. If a man wants you, you go with him and make him happy enough that he wants to come back and try the novelty again. I've got plenty of natural girls offering natural sex. If you're going to go north, you'd better start offering something more.
He upends his drink, gulping it, and slaps the glass down on the bar for Diane to refill.
Now quit sulking and start earning.
Chapter 16. Hak-sung scowls at the safe where it squats across from him. It's early morning in the Spring Life office, and he should be busy forging a ledger before Mr. Lake arrives. But the safe is all he can focus on. It mocks him, sitting there, enveloped in the smoke of offerings which have done nothing to open it. Ever since the anchor pad incident, the safe is always locked. And now the Devil Lake is always looking over his shoulder, asking about the state of accounts, always prying and asking questions. And still the Dung Lord waits. Hak-sung has seen him twice more. Each time the man has been patient, and yet Hak-sung senses a growing irritation, a willingness perhaps to take matters into his own hands. The window of opportunity is closing. Hak-sung scratches numbers into the ledger, reconciling the money he skimmed from the purchase of a temporary spindle. Should he simply rob the safe, take the risk of suspicion falling on himself? There are industrial supplies in the factory that would burn through the iron in mere hours. Is this better than making the Dung Lord wait, risking that the godfather of all godfathers will do the deed himself? Hak-sung ponders his options. All his choices come loaded with risks that make his skin crawl. If the safe is damaged, his face will soon be plastered on lampposts. And it is a very bad time to be an enemy of the foreign devils. With Akarat in ascendancy, the Farang are also on the rise. Every day brings more news of white shirt humiliation. The Tiger of Bangkok is now a shaven-headed monk without family or property. What if Mr. Lake were removed entirely? An anonymous knife in the gut as he walks down the street, perhaps. It would be easy. Cheap, even. For 15 baht, Laughing Chan would do it willingly, and the foreign devil would trouble Hak-sung no more. A knock at the door startles him. Hak-sung straightens and shoves the newly forged ledger under the desk.
Yes?
It's Mai, the skinny girl from the production line, standing at the threshold. Hak-sung relaxes slightly as she whys.
Kun, there is a difficulty.
He uses a cloth to wipe the ink from his hands.
Yes, what is it?
Her eyes flick around the room.
It would be better if you came yourself.
She positively reeks of fear. The hairs on the back of Hak-sung's neck prickle. She's little more than a child. He has done her decent favors. She has even earned bonuses crawling down the tight passages of the drivetrains, inspecting the links as they brought the factory back into working order,
and yet something in her demeanor reminds him of when the Malays turned on his people. When his workers, always so loyal and appreciative, suddenly could not look him in the eye. If he had been clever, he would have seen the turn of the tide, seen that the days of the Malayan Chinese were numbered. But even a man of his stature, who gave freely to charities, who helped his employees' children as if they were his own, that even his head was slated to be stacked in a gutter. And now here is Mai, looking shifty. Is this the way they will come for him, furtive, sending a harmless-looking girl as bait? Is this the end of the yellow cards? Is it the Dung Lord moving against him? Hak Sung feigns nonchalance and reclines slightly in his chair even as he watches her. If you have something to say, he murmurs, then say it now, here. She hesitates. Her fear is obvious.
Is the Farang near?
Hak Sung glances at the clock on the wall. 6 o'clock. He shouldn't be here for another hour or two. He is seldom early.
Please, if you could just come.
So this is the way it will be. He nods shortly. Yes, of course. He stands and crosses to her. Such a pretty girl. Of course they would send a pretty one. She looks so harmless. He scratches at his back, lifting the loose hem of his shirt and slips the knife out, holds it behind his back as he approaches, waits until the last moment. He grabs her hair and yanks her close, presses the knife against her throat.
Who sent you? The Dung Lord? White Shirts? Who?
She gasps, unable to free herself without cutting her throat.
No one? Do you think I'm a fool?
He presses the knife home, breaking skin.
Who is it?
No one, I swear.
She is shaking with fear, but Hak Sung doesn't release her. Is there something you wish to say? Some secret you must keep? Tell it now. She gasps at the pressure of his blade on her neck.
No, Kun, I swear, no secret, but...
Yes.
She sags against him.
The White Shirts.
She whispers.
If the White Shirts find out...
I'm no White Shirt.
It's Kit. Kit is ill. And Three Muang. Both of them. Please. I don't know what to do. I don't want to lose the job. I don't know what to do. Please don't tell the Farang. Everyone knows the Farang might close the factory. Please. My family needs, please, please.
She is sobbing now, sagging against him, begging him as if he might be her savior, mindless of the knife. Hak Sung grimaces and pulls the knife away, suddenly feeling old. This is what it is to live in fear. To suspect 13-year-old girls. To think that daughter mouths intend your death. He feels sick. He can't meet her eyes.
You should have said so.
He mutters gruffly.
Stupid girl. These are not matters to be coy about.
He lifts his shirt and slides the knife back into its sheath.
Show me your friends.
She carefully wipes her tears away. She is not resentful. She is adaptable, as young people often are. But the crisis passed. She obediently leads him out of the office. Down on the factory floor, workers are beginning to arrive. The great doors rattle wide and sun pours into the huge hall. Dung and dust motes swirl in the light. Mai leads him through the fining room, kicking through pale dust residue and on to the cutting rooms. Overhead, the screens of algae fill the room with the sea reek of their drying. She leads him past the cutting presses and ducks under the line.
On the other side, the algae tanks sit in silent ranks, full of salt and life. More than half of the tanks show signs of reduced production. Algae barely covers their surfaces, even though the skim should be more than 4 inches thick after a night without harvesting.
There,
Mai whispers, pointing. Kit and Sri Mwang both lie against the wall. The two men look up at Hak Sung with dull eyes. Hak Sung kneels close but doesn't touch.
Have they eaten together?
I don't think so. They are not friends.
It couldn't be Sivaskosis. Blister rust. No.
He shakes his head.
I'm a stupid old man. It is neither. There is no blood on their lips.
Kit moans, tries to sit up. Hak Sung flinches away, fighting an urge to wipe his hands on his shirt. The other man, Sri Mwang, looks even worse.
What was this one's responsibility?
Mai hesitates.
I think he fed the tanks. Poured the sacks of fish meal for the algae.
Hak Sung's skin crawls. Two bodies. Lying beside the tanks that Hak Sung himself brought back to full production for the benefit of Mr. Anderson, rushing to please him. Is it coincidence? He shivers, eyeing the room from a new perspective. Overflow from the vats dampens the floor in pools near the rusting drains. Blooms of algae decorate the damp surface, feeding on leftover nutrients. Vectors everywhere, if there is something wrong with the tanks. Hak Sung instinctively starts to wipe his hands, then stops short, skin crawling anew. The gray powders of the fining room cling to his palms, marking where he pushed the curtains aside as he passed through. He's surrounded by potential vectors. Overhead, the drying screens hang suspended, their racks filling the warehouse dimness, bank after bank smeared with blackening skim. A drop of water falls from a screen, spatters the floor beside his foot, and with it comes awareness of a new sound. He never heard it when the factory was full of people, but now, in this early morning quiet, it is all around. The gentle patter of rain from the screens above. Hak Sung stands abruptly, fighting rising panic.
Don't be a fool. You don't know it is the algae. Death comes in many forms. It could be any sort of disease.
Kit's breathing is strangely ragged in the stillness. A panting bellows as his chest rises and falls.
Do you think it is pandemic?
Mai asks. Hak Sung glares at her.
Don't say those words. Do you wish to bring demons down on us, white shirts? If news gets out, they'll shut down the factory. We'll be starving like yellow cards.
But...
Outside in the main hall, voices echo.
Hush, child.
Hak Sung motions her to silence, thinking furiously. A white shirt investigation would be disastrous. Just the excuse the foreign devil, Mr. Lake, would need to shut the place down, to fire Hak Sung, to send him back to the towers to starve, to die after coming so far, after coming so close. More morning greetings echo from the rest of the factory. A megadont groans, doors rattle wide, the main flywheels rumble to life as someone runs a line test.
What should we do?
Mai asks. Hak Sung glances around at the vats and machinery, the still empty rooms.
You're the only one who knows they are sick.
Mai nods.
I found them when I came in.
You're sure? You didn't mention it to anyone else as you came to find me. No one else has been in here. No one was here with you and perhaps thought they would take the day off when they saw these two?
Mai shakes her head.
No, I came alone. I catch a ride with a farmer near the edge of the city. He brings me on his long tail up the Klongs. I always get here early.
Hak-Sung looks down at the two men, then at the girl. Four of them in the room. Four. He winces at the thought. Such an unlucky number, four.
Shz. Four. Shz.
Death.
A better number is three. Or two. Or one. One is the ideal number for a secret.
Unconsciously, Hak-Sung's hand strays to his knife, considering the girl. Messy, but still less messy than the number four. The girl's long black hair is tied up in a careful bun at the top of her head to keep it free of running line equipment. Her neck is exposed. Her eyes are trusting. Hak-Sung looks away, evaluating the bodies again, calculating against inauspicious numbers.
Four, four,
four. Death. One is better. One is best. He takes a breath and makes a decision. He reaches for her.
Come here.
She hesitates. He scowls at her, waves her closer.
You want to keep your job, yes?
She nods slowly.
Then come. These two need to go to a hospital, yes? We cannot help them here. And two sick men lying beside the algae baths will do none of us any good. Not if we want to keep on eating. Gather them and meet me at the side door. Not through the main room. The side one. Go under the line with them. Through the service access. The side, you understand?
She nods uncertainly. He claps his hands together, spurring her to action.
Quickly now, quickly! Drag them if you must.
He motions to the bodies.
People will be arriving. One person is already too many to keep a secret, and here we stand four. Let's make this a secret of two at least. Anything is better than four.
Death. She takes a frightened breath, then her eyes narrow with determination. She crouches to wrestle with Kit's body. Hak-Sung watches to make sure she is underway, then ducks out. In the main hall, people are still stowing their lunches and laughing. No one in a rush. The Thai are lazy.
If they were Chinese yellow cards, they would already be working and all would be lost. For once, Hak-Sung is glad he works with Thais.
He still has a little time. He ducks out the side door. Outside, the alley is empty. High factory walls pin the narrow way. Hak-Sung jogs toward Pawsri Street and its jumble of breakfast stalls, steaming noodles and ragged children. A cycle rickshaw flashes across the gap.
Wei!
He calls out.
Sam Lo! Sam Lo! Wait!
But he is too far away. He limps to the intersection, favoring his bad knee, catches sight of another rickshaw. He flags the driver. The man glances behind to see if he is threatened by competition, then angles toward Hak-Sung with a lackadaisical pedal, allowing the slight slope of the street to let him coast.
Faster!
Hak-Sung shouts.
Kwai Yidian, you dog fucker!
The man ignores the abuse, lets his cycle coast to a stop.
You called me, Kun.
Hak-Sung climbs in and waves down the alley.
I have passengers for you if you'll hurry up.
The man grunts and steers down the narrow way. The cycle's chain clicks sedately. Hak-Sung grits his teeth.
Double pay! Quickly, quickly!
He motions the man onward. The man leans on his pedals marginally more aggressively, but still he shambles like a megadont. Ahead Mai appears. For a moment Hak-Sung is afraid that she will be stupid and bring out the bodies before the rickshaw arrives, but Kit is nowhere in sight. It is only when the rickshaw comes close that she slips back inside and drags the first incoherent worker into view. The rickshaw man shies at the body, but Hak-Sung leans over his shoulder and hisses, "Triple pay!" He grabs Kit and wrestles him into the rickshaw seat before the man can protest. Mai disappears back inside. The cycle rickshaw man eyes Kit.
"What's wrong with him?"
"He's a drunk," Hak-Sung says. "He and his friend. If the boss catches them, they're fired."
"He doesn't look drunk."
"You're mistaken."
"No, that one looks like..."
Hak-Sung stares at the man.
"The white shirts will cast their net over you as surely as they will me. He is on your seat, in your breathing presence."
The rickshaw man's eyes widen. He draws back. Hak-Sung nods confirmation, holding the man's gaze.
"There's no point in making a complaint now. I say they're drunk. Triple pay to you when you return."
Maya reappears with the second worker, and Hak-Sung helps lever him into the seat. He ushers Maya into the rickshaw with the men.
"Hospitals,"
he says, and then he leans close.
"But different hospitals, yes?"
Maya nods sharply.
"Good.
Clever girl."
Hak-Sung steps back.
"Go on, then. Go. Beat it."
The rickshaw man sets off, pedaling much faster than before. Hak-Sung watches them ride away. The heads of the three passengers and the rickshaw man rattling and bouncing as the bike's wheels chatter over cobbles. He grimaces. 4 again. A bad number for certain. He pushes paranoia away, wondering if he is even capable of strategizing these days. An old man who jumps at shadows. Would he be better off if Mai and Kit and Sreemwang were feeding redfin pla in the murky waters of the Chao Phraya River? If they were just a collection of anonymous parts, bobbing amongst the roiling bodies of hungry carp, would he not be safer?
4.
Shh.
Death. His skin crawls at the proximity of sickness. He rubs his hands unconsciously against his trousers. He'll have to bathe. Rub down with a chlorine bleach scrub and hope it does the job. The rickshaw man turns out of sight, carrying his diseased cargo. Hak-Sung heads back inside, to the factory floor, where the lines rattle with test runs and voices call out to one another in morning greeting.
"Please let it be coincidence," he prays.
"Please don't let it be the line."
Chapter 17. How many nights has he gone without sleep? 1 night? 10 nights? 10,000? Jaidi cannot remember anymore. Moons have passed awake and suns have passed in dream and everything is counting. Numbers spinning out in a steady accumulation of days and hopes dashed. Propitiations and offerings unanswered. Fortune tellers with their predictions. Generals with their assurances. Tomorrow. 3 days for certain. There are indications of a softening. Whispers of a woman's whereabouts. Patience. Jayen. Cool heart. Nothing. Apologies and humiliations in the newspapers. A personal criticism by his own hand. More false admissions of greed and corruption. 200,000 baht that he cannot repay. Editorials and condemnations in the whisper sheets. Stories spread by his enemies that he spent stolen money on whores, on a private stock of Utex rice against famines. That he squirreled it away for personal benefit. The tiger was nothing more than another corrupt white shirt. Fines are meted out. The last of his property confiscated. The family home burned. A funeral pyre. While his mother-in-law wails and his sons, already stripped of his name, watch somnolent. It has been decided that he will not serve his penance in a nearby monastery. Instead, he will be banished to the forests of Prakritapong, where ivory beetle has turned the land into waste, and where blister rust rewrites waft across the border from Burma. Banished to the wastelands to contemplate the Dhamma. His eyebrows are shaved. His head is a simple pate. If he happens to return from his penance alive, he looks forward to a lifetime of guarding yellow cards and their interments down in the south. The lowest work for the lowest white shirt. And yet, still no word of Chaya. Is she alive? Is she dead? Was it trade? Was it another? A Jao Por incensed at Jaidi's audacity. Was it someone within the Environment Ministry? The Rombakti, irritated at Jaidi's disregard for protocol. Was it meant as a kidnapping or murder? Did she die fighting to get free? Is she still in that concrete room of the photograph, somewhere in the city, sweating in an abandoned tower, waiting for him to rescue her? Does her corpse feed Cheshire's in an alley? Does she float in the Chao Phraya? Food now for the body cop Rev 2.3, that the ministry has bred with such success. He has nothing but questions. He shouts into the well, but no echo returns. And so now he sits in a barren monk's kuti on the temple grounds of Wat Bawanawet, waiting to hear whether Prakritipang's monastery will actually accept the task of reforming him. He wears the white of a novice. He will not wear orange. Not ever. He is not a monk. He does a special penance. His eyes follow rusty water stains on the wall, the blooms of mold and rot. On one wall, a bow tree is painted, the Buddha sitting beneath it as he seeks enlightenment. Suffering. All is suffering. Jaidi stares at the bow tree. Just another relic of history. The ministry has artificially preserved a few, ones that didn't burst to kindling under the internal pressure of the ivory beetles breeding, the beetles burrowing and hatching in the tangled trunks of the bow until they burst forth flying and spread to their next victim and their next and their next. All is transient. Even bow trees cannot last. Jaidi touches his eyebrows, fingering the pale half-moons above his eyes where hair once stood. He still hasn't gotten used to his shaven state. Everything changes. He stares up at the bow tree and the Buddha. I was asleep. All along. I was asleep and never understood. But now, as he stares at the relic bow tree, something shifts. Nothing lasts forever. A kuti is a cell. This cell is a prison. He sits in a prison while the ones who took Chaya live and drink and whore and laugh. Nothing is permanent. This is the central teaching of the Buddha. Not a career, not an institution, not a wife, not a tree. All is change. Change is the only truth. He stretches a hand toward the painting and traces the flaking paint, wondering if the man who painted it used a real living bow tree as a model, if he was lucky enough to live when they lived, or if he modeled it from a photo, copied from a copy. In 1,000 years, will they even know that bow trees existed? Will Niwat and Surat's great-grandchildren know that there were other fig trees, also all gone? Will they know that there were many, many trees, and that there were of many types? Not just a Gates teak and a gene-ripped percal banana, but many, many others as well. Will they understand that we were not fast enough or smart enough to save them all? That we had to make choices? The Grahamites who preach on the streets of Bangkok all talk of their holy Bible and its stories of salvation. They're stories of Noah Bodhisattva, who saved all the animals and trees and flowers on his great bamboo raft and helped them cross the waters, all the broken pieces of the world piled atop his raft while he hunted for land. But there is no Noah Bodhisattva now. There is only Prasubh, who feels the pain of loss, but can do little to stop it, and the little mud Buddhas of the Environment Ministry, who hold back rising waters by barest luck. The bow tree blurs. Jaidi's cheeks are wet with tears. Still he stares up at it and the Buddha in his pose of meditation. Who would have thought the calorie companies would attack figs? Who would have thought the bow trees would die as well? The Farang have no respect for anything but money. He wipes the water off his face. It is stupid to think that anything lasts forever. Perhaps even Buddhism is transient. He stands and gathers his white novice robes around him. He wise to the flaking paint of the Buddha under his disappeared tree. Outside, the moon shines bright. A few green methane lamps glow, barely lighting the paths through the re-engineered teak trees to the monastery gates. It is foolish to grasp for things that cannot be regained. All things die. Chaya is already lost to him. Such is change. No one guards the gates. It is assumed that he is obedient, that he will scrape and beg for any hope of Chaya's return, that he will allow himself to be broken. He's not even sure if anyone cares now about his final fate. He has served his purpose, dealt a blow to General Pracha, lost face for the entire Environment Ministry. If he stays or leaves, what of it? He walks out onto the night streets of the City of Divine Beings and heads south, toward the river, toward the Grand Palace and the glittering lights of the city, down through streets half-populated, toward the levees that keep the city from drowning under the curse of the Farang. The city pillar shrine rises ahead of him, its roofs gleaming. Buddha images alight with offerings, sweet incense pouring from them. It was here that Rama the 12th declared that the city of Krung Thep would not be abandoned, would not fall to the likes of the Farang the way that Ayutthaya fell to the Burmese so many centuries before. Over the chanting of 999 monks dressed in saffron robes, the king declared that the city would be saved, and from that moment he charged the Ministry of the Environment with its defense. Charged them with the building of the great levees and the tide pools that would buffer the city against the wash of monsoon flood and the surge of typhoon waves. Krung Thep would stand. Jaidi walks on, listening to the steady chant of monks who pray every minute of the day, summoning the power of the spirit world to Bangkok's aid. There were times when he himself knelt in the cool marble of the shrine, prostrate before the city's central pillar, begging for the help of the king and the spirits and whatever life force the city was imbued with as he went forth to do his work. The city pillar was talismanic. It gave him faith. Now he walks past in his white robes and doesn't look twice. All things are transient. He continues through the streets, makes his way into the crowded quarters along the back of Chao Ruan Klong. The waters lap quietly. No one poles its dark surface this late at night. But ahead, on one of the screened porches, a candle flickers. He steals closer. Kanya! His old lieutenant turns, surprised. She composes her features, but not before Jaidi has a chance to read her shock at what stands before her. This forgotten man without a hair on his head, without even his eyebrows, grinning madly at her from the foot of her steps. He removes his sandals and climbs in, white like a ghost, up the stairs. Jaidi is aware of the appearance he presents. Can't help but enjoy the humor as he opens the screens and slips within.
I thought you had already gone to the forests, Kanya says.
Jaidi settles beside her, arranging his robes around him. He stares out at the stinking waters of the Klong. A mango tree's branches reflect against the moonlight liquid silver.
It takes a long time to find a monastery willing to soil itself with my sort.
Even Prak Ridipong seems to have second thoughts when it comes to enemies of trade. Kanya makes a face.
Everyone talks about how they are in ascendancy. Akarat speaks openly of allowing wind-up imports.
Jaidi startles. I hadn't heard of such. A few farang, but... Kanya makes a face.
All respect to the queen, but wind-ups do not riot.
She forces her thumb into the hard peel of a mangosteen. Its purple skin, nearly black in the darkness, peels away.
Torapi measuring his father's footprints.
Jaidi shrugs.
All things change.
Kanya grimaces.
How can one fight their money? Money is their power. Who remembers their patrons? Who remembers their obligations when money comes surging in as strong and deep as the ocean against the seawalls?
She grimaces.
We are not fighting the rising waters. We are fighting money.
Money is attractive. Kanya makes a bitter face.
Not to you. You were a monk, even before they sent you to Akuti.
Perhaps that's why I make such a poor novice.
Shouldn't you be in your Kuti now?
Jaidi grins.
It was cramping my style.
Kanya stills, looks hard at Jaidi.
You're not ordaining?
I'm a fighter, not a monk. He shrugs. Sitting in a kuti and meditating will do no good. I let myself become confused about that. Losing Chaya confused me.
She will return, I'm sure of it.
Jaidi smiles sadly at his protege, so full of hope and faith. It's surprising that a woman who smiles so little and sees so much melancholy in the world can believe that in this case, this one exceptional case, that the world will turn in a positive direction. No. She will not.
She will.
Jaidi shakes his head. I always thought you were the skeptical one. Kanya's face is anguished.
You've done everything to signal capitulation. You have no face left. They must let her go.
They will not. I think that she was dead within a day.
I only clung to hope because I was mad for her.
You don't know she's dead. They could still be holding her.
As you pointed out, I have no face left. If this were a lesson, she would have returned by now. It was a different sort of message than we thought.
Jaidi contemplates the still waters of the Klong.
I need a favor from you. Anything.
Loan me a spring gun.
Kanya's eyes widen. Kun!
Don't worry. I'll bring it back. I don't need you to come with me. I just need a good weapon.
I...
Jaidi grins. Don't worry, I'll be fine. And there's no reason to destroy two careers.
You're going after trade.
Akarat needs to understand
that the tiger still has teeth.
You don't even know if it was Trade who took her.
Who else, really?
Jaidi shrugs.
I have made many enemies, but in the end, there is really only one.
He smiles.
There is Trade and there is me.
I was foolish to let people convince me otherwise.
I'll come with you.
No. You will stay here. You will keep an eye on Niwot and Surat.
That is all I ask of you, Lieutenant.
Please don't do this. I will beg Pracha. I will go to Jaidi cuts her off before she speaks of ugliness.
There was a time when he would have let her lose face before him, would have allowed her apologies to spill forth, like a waterfall during the monsoon. But not anymore.
I don't wish for anything else, he says. I am content. I will go to Trade and I will make them pay. All of this is karma. I was not meant to keep Chaya forever, or she to keep me. But I think there are still things we can do if we hold tight to our Dhamma. We all have our duties, Kanya. To our patrons, to our men.
He shrugs. I've had many different lives. I was a boy, and a Muay Thai champion, and a father, and a white shirt. He glances down at the folds of his novice's clothes. A monk, even. He grins. Don't worry about me. I have a few more stages yet to traverse before I give up on this life and go to meet Chaya. He lets his voice harden. I still have unfinished business, and I won't stop until it is done.
Kanya watches him, eyes anguished.
You can't go alone.
No. I will take Somchai. Trade. The ministry that functions with impunity. That scoffs at him so easily. That steals his wife and leaves a hole in him the size of a durian.
Chaya.
Jaidi studies the building. In the face of all those blazing lights, he feels like a savage in the wilderness. Like a hill tribe spirit doctor staring at the advance of a megadont army. For a moment, his sense of mission falters.
I should see the boys, he tells himself. I could go home.
And yet, here he is in the darkness, watching the lights of the Ministry of Trade, where they burn their coal allocation as though the contraction never happened. As though there are no seawalls needed to keep back the ocean. Somewhere in there a man squats and plans. The man who watched him at the anchor pad so long ago. Who spat beetle and sauntered away as if Jaidi was nothing more than a cockroach to be crushed. Who sat beside Akarat and observed silently as Jaidi was thrown down. That man will lead to Chaya's resting place. That man is the key. Somewhere inside those glowing windows. Jaidi ducks back into the darkness. He and Somchai wear dark street clothes, stripped of all identifiers, the better to blend with the night. Somchai's a fast one of the best, dangerous, close in and quiet. He knows his way around a lock, and like Jaidi, he is motivated. Somchai's face is serious as he studies the building. Almost as serious as Kanya, when Jaidi considers it. The demeanor seems to creep up on all of them eventually. Seems to come with the work. Jaidi wonders if the Tai ever really smiled, as he has heard in legends. Every time he hears his boys laugh, it is as if some beautiful orchid has blossomed in the forest.
They sell themselves cheaply. Somchai murmurs.
Jidy nods shortly.
I remember when trade was just a bit portfolio under agriculture, and now look at it.
You're showing your age. Trade was always a big ministry.
No.
Just a tiny department.
A joke.
Jidy waves at the new complex, with its high-tech convection vents, with its awnings and porticos.
It's a new world once again.
As if to taunt him, a pair of Cheshires jump up on a balustrade to preen and wash. They molt in and out of view, careless of discovery.
Jidy pulls out a spring gun and takes aim.
That's what trade has given us.
Cheshire should be on their badge.
Please don't.
He looks at Somchai.
It carries no karmic cost. They have no soul. They bleed like any other animal. You could say the same of ivory beetles.
Somchai ducks his head but doesn't say anything more. Jidy scowls and puts his spring gun back in its holster. It would be a waste of ammunition anyway.
There are always more. I used to be in the poison details for Cheshire's.
Somchai says finally.
Now it's you who shows your age.
Somchai shrugs.
I had a family then. I didn't know.
Sibiscosis 118, double A. It was quick.
I remember.
My father died with that one as well. A bad iteration.
Somchai nods.
I miss them. I hope they reincarnated well.
I'm sure they did.
He shrugs.
One can hope. I became a monk for them.
Ordained for a full year. I prayed. Did many offerings.
He says again,
one can hope.
The Cheshires yowl again as Somchai watches.
I've killed thousands of them.
Thousands.
I've killed 6 men in my life, and never regretted any of them. But I've killed thousands of Cheshires and have never felt at ease.
He pauses, scratches behind his ear at a bloom of arrested fagon fringe.
I sometimes wonder if my family's sibiscosis was karmic retribution for all those Cheshires.
It couldn't be.
They're not natural.
Somchai shrugs.
They breed. They eat. They live. They breathe.
He smiles slightly.
If you pet them, they will purr.
Jidy makes a face of disgust.
It's true. I've touched them. They are real, as much as you or I.
They're just empty vessels. No soul fills them.
Somchai shrugs.
Maybe even the worst monstrosities of the Japanese live in some way. I worry that Noi and Chart and Mali and Prem have been reborn in wind-up bodies. Not all of us are good enough to become Contraction P. Maybe some of us become wind-ups in Japanese factories. Working, you know. We're so few in comparison to the past. Where did all the souls go? Maybe to the Japanese. Maybe into wind-ups.
Jidy masks his uneasiness in the direction of Somchai's words.
It's impossible.
Somchai shrugs again. Still,
I could not bear to hunt a Cheshire again.
Then let's hunt men.
Across the street, a door is opening, and a ministry worker steps outside. Jayadi is already crossing the street, sprinting to catch the man. Their target strides to a rack of bicycles and bends down to unlock a wheel. Jayadi's club slides free. The man looks up and gasps, and then Jayadi is on top of him, baton swinging. The man has time to raise an arm. Jayadi swats it aside, and then he is inside the man's reach and clubs him across the head. Somchai catches up.
You're fast for an old man.
Jayadi smiles.
Take his feet.
They lug the body back across the street, slipping into the puddled blackness between the methane lamps. Jayadi goes through his pockets. Keys jingle. He grins and raises them to show the prize. He ties the man quickly, blindfolds and gags him. A Cheshire drifts close, watching, a molting of calico and shadow and stone. Will the Cheshires eat him? Somchai wonders.
If you cared, you would have let me kill him.
Somchai ponders this but doesn't say anything. Jayadi finishes binding the man.
Come on.
They jog back across the street, slip to the door. The key enters easily, and they are inside. In the glare of electricity, Jayadi stifles the urge to locate light switches and plunge the ministry into darkness.
Stupid to have people working so late.
Burning all this carbon. Somchai shrugs.
Our man may be here in the building even now.
Not if he's lucky. But Jayadi has the same thought. He wonders if he will be able to restrain himself if he catches Chaya's killer. Wonders why he should. They slip through more lighted halls. A few people are still present, but no one gives them a second glance as they stride by. Both of them walk with authority, have the air of men others must defer to. Jayadi acknowledges others with a quick inclination of his head as he walks past. Eventually he finds the records offices he requires. Somchai and Jayadi pause in front of glass doors. Jayadi hefts his baton.
Glass.
Somchai notes.
You want to try?
Somchai examines the lock, pulls out a set of tools, sets to work probing the aperture, massaging its tumblers. Jayadi stands behind him, waiting impatiently. The corridor blazes with light. Somchai fiddles with the locks.
Never mind.
Jayadi hefts his baton.
Move aside.
The shattering is quick. The sound echoes and fades. They wait for footsteps, but there are none. They both slip inside and proceed to rifle through the cabinets. Eventually, Jayadi finds the personnel files, and then there is a long period of examining poor photographs, of setting aside ones that seem familiar, sifting, sorting.
He knew me, Jayadi mutters.
He looked right at me.
Everyone knows you,
Somchai observes. You are famous. Jayadi grimaces. You think he was at the anchor pads to collect something? Or just there for the inspections themselves?
Well, perhaps they wanted whatever was in Carlisle's holds, or some other dirigible that aborted arrival and dropped in occupied Lana instead. There are 1,000 possibilities, no?
Here! Jayadi points. This is the one.
You're sure? His face was narrower, I thought.
I'm sure of it. Somchai frowns as he scans the file over Jayadi's shoulder.
A low-level man. Not important at all. No one with influence.
Jayadi shakes his head.
No.
He has power. I saw the way he looked at me. He was at the ceremony when I was demoted. He frowns. There is no address information from him.